Good day. All sites are now online in a listen-only mode. Later, there will be an opportunity to ask questions during our Q&A segment. Please note this call is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Steve Gaines. Go ahead, please.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us. My name is Steve Gaines. I am the Dean of the Bren School of Environmental Science and Management at the University of California at Santa Barbara, and I'll be moderating the session today. This session and panel is stimulated by a new report to be released tomorrow in the journal Science on new insight on the status of the world's fisheries and its implications for food security and other issues. We will have four speakers on the panel during this listen-only mode. They are Professor Christopher Costello, an economist at the Bren School of Environmental Science and Management at the University of California at Santa Barbara, who is the lead author on the article. Amanda Leland, who is the Vice President for the Oceans Program at the Environmental Defense Fund. Brett Jenks, who is President and CEO of RARE. And Michael Arbuckle, who is the Senior Fisheries Specialist at the World Bank. They will be speaking in that order for roughly 3 minutes each. And then we will begin with Professor Christopher Costello, who will be talking about the key findings of the report.
Great. Thank you, Steve. Let me just make a few comments about our study and what we found. And first, I'll start by way of background and tell you that unassessed fisheries, which is the subset of fisheries in the world that we focused on, comprise about 80% of the global catch and constitute the vast majority of the world's 10,000 or so fisheries. We found that small-scale unassessed fisheries in the world are in substantially worse shape than was previously thought, though only a small subset of those have actually collapsed, which suggests that that recovery is likely to be possible for those fisheries. We were able to break down those results by fishery type and region. We found that slow-growing and late-maturing fish, things like sharks and many coastal fish, tend to be in the worst shape. We also found that the problem isn't just in developing countries. Many developed countries with unassessed fisheries face similar challenges. In addition to calculating this fishery status, we were able to estimate the trends in this status over time, and we found that both small and large unassessed fisheries are in continued decline. So then we turned our efforts towards recovery, and I'm an economist, and I always think it's worth pointing out that the best way for a fishery to provide value to society is to fish that stock sustainably. You make more money doing that than say, catching all the fish today and sticking the money in an investment. So while recovering these depleted stocks may have short-run costs, in the long run it will provide increased food through increased harvest in the future, increased economic prosperity for those local communities that fish them, and, of course, conservation because there will be more fish in the sea. Our estimates suggest that about 64% of these unassessed stocks in the world could provide increased sustainable harvest if they were rebuilt. And on a global scale, we think that this means that recovery really is attainable. And if we did that, we would increase fishery abundance among these unassessed stocks by about 56%. So when you stick your head underwater in Indonesia or the Philippines, you'll see 56% more fish there. Now, there's a number of important ways or important mechanisms that can help solve this problem. There are tools that have proven to be useful in many parts of the world, and I'd like to just highlight two. The first is to provide exclusive access rights to communities or cooperatives or individual fishermen, and this gives them a long-run stake in the health of the resource. And often these exclusive access rights can be coupled with conservation measures like marine protected areas. And I think a little bit later on the call you'll hear about some efforts ongoing right now that actually do this. They call it the turf reserve system, and I think it's a very promising approach to recover some of these depleted stocks and fish them sustainably after that. The second tool I'd like to highlight is something called a data poor assessment. We focused on the unassessed fisheries, the fisheries without stock assessments, and formal stock assessments cost a lot. They cost about $500,000 these data poor assessments can be done for much less, and I think are practical at a small scale for many of these fisheries. Finally, I'd like to just say that our study that will be published in Science tomorrow is part of a larger study by the California Environmental Associates, which, in my opinion, lays out a much more comprehensive analysis of global success stories, problem areas, and it's a starting point as a blueprint for future action. Steve, those are my comments.
Thank you, Chris, for laying out the findings. What we want to focus on with the next three speakers is the implications of the findings of these reports to thinking about solutions, the topics that Chris alluded to at the end of his comments. And so our next speaker will be Amanda Leland from the Environmental Defense Fund, talking about successes with rights-based management.
Thank you, Steve. So from my perspective, this study provides the path for recovering the world's ocean fish populations. 5 years ago, I would have been terrified by this report, but today I have hope that we can turn fisheries around, and I have confidence that we can actually do it. It may seem a little counterintuitive for an environmentalist like me to say this, but what we've learned is that by giving fishermen a stake in protecting the oceans, we can actually succeed in turning declining fisheries around. The revolution here is to empower fishermen to lead the way in recovering fish populations. As Chris mentioned, exclusive access rights, or what is also called rights-based management, is going to be key to recovery. Rights-based management is also known as catch shares in the U.S., and that basically it is a system that provides rights or secure privileges to fishermen, gives them responsibilities for managing the fishery sustainably, and rewards them when the fishery improves. Giving fishermen a concrete stake in the fishery means that they're invested in protecting it. When overfishing ends, the amount the entire fleet can catch increases, as does each individual or community's share of that catch. Economic interests and conservation interests align and go hand in hand, and fishermen lead the way. There are lessons to be learned from the U.S., which has turned a corner. Fisheries have reached a 17-year high here. Values have increased, thanks in part to catch shares, which are growing fish populations. 65% of all fish that are now caught in U.S. waters come in under catch share management or rights-based management approaches. EDF has partnered with fishermen in many countries to transform fisheries management. And here are three examples with some stunning results, and these are the results that give me hope for the future. Last year, catch shares in three fisheries alone in the U.S. saved enough fish from being tossed back dead at sea to feed about 1 million Americans their seafood for an entire year. That's 15.9 million pounds of fish saved in just 1 year under catch shares. Perhaps the biggest revolution has taken place in the Pacific, where catch share fishermen have established marine protected areas outside of government intervention to help avoid sensitive fish species. This is a complete 180 turnaround, really. It wasn't that long ago that fishermen fought tooth and nail against any marine protected areas, and now they're creating them themselves. This model is also working in the developing world in unassessed fisheries. In Belize, after just 1 year of catch shares, fishermen report an 80% increase in compliance and enforcement. 70% of fishermen report an increase in their catch, and 85% of fishermen are now submitting catch data, up from zero the year before. In a place where unassessed fisheries are the norm, with few rules or incentives to follow them, rights-based management is working and is turning the fishery around. The key is to empower fishermen by giving them incentives to recover fish populations. Without making this work for the fishermen themselves, there'll be no way to stop the global decline and conserve the fisheries that will be so important to feed the world's growing population. This study shows that recovering the world's fisheries is absolutely critical, and by working with fishermen, it's also completely achievable. Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, Amanda. Next, we will have Brett Jenks from Rare talking about another class of solutions that Chris mentioned, the combination of turfs and reserves. Brett.
Great. Thanks, Steve. So the bottom line for Rare is that the glass is half full, as outlined in this report, but it's not hard to envision ways of filling it back up. You know, while some will read in this report another dark cloud over global fisheries, we see a very compelling silver lining. Unlike most doom and gloom findings about fisheries, Chris and Steve and their colleagues have wisely emphasized the recovery made possible when governments and fishers are willing to make a few basic changes. So as Amanda outlined, when you provide fishers with exclusive access to their fisheries in the form of territorial use rights or turfs, in exchange for setting up and protecting no-take zones, the engines of fish recovery for nearshore fisheries, the results can be pretty dramatic, and they include increased fish stocks, richer marine habitats, and coastlines that are, over time, less vulnerable to climate change. The solution here is unleashing the self-interest of local fishers to advance both conservation and economic development over the long term. And from my perspective, this paper underscores that fish recovery is not only possible, but that the means of recovering fisheries globally is perhaps one of the biggest opportunities globally for marine habitat preservation, because it is in our collective self-interest to protect the natural infrastructure on which these fisheries depend. So this is a big deal. If you follow their logic, tropical nations adopting turf reserve systems en masse can not only recover local fisheries, but one could do the math and calculate that they could produce enough additional fish to sustainably feed millions, if not eventually hundreds of millions, of coastal people. So from a conservation standpoint, this is critical. But from a food security standpoint, this is also critical, because in the process of establishing these rights in exchange for setting up no-take zones, these can be strategically placed to protect coral reefs, mangroves, and seagrass beds. Our own experience at Rare is bearing this out, and if we look back at just 2012, we've had nearly 70 active fish pilot fish recovery sites, or no-take zones, in Indonesia, the Philippines, and throughout Latin America. And using our methodology and partnering with governments and NGOs and local fishing communities to improve how they manage their fisheries, we're starting to get some really compelling evidence. So this report looks at global fisheries in the aggregate. What gets really exciting is when you begin to look at individual cases. So we just completed 12 of these pilot projects in the Philippines, and these provide our first indicators of success. A preliminary independent analysis from the University of the Philippines found that across those 12 sites, inside no-take zones, or the reserve element of a turf reserve, fish biomass increased by on average 40%, and that's just in 12 months, with fish abundance increasing on average by 47% in that same year. Amazingly, at one site, which I personally visited twice in the last year, we saw a 433% increase in fish biomass inside the no-take zone. So whether in the aggregate or in the individual case, there's compelling evidence to that echoes what other speakers here have said, which is fish recovery is possible, and there are various ways of getting there. What we need to do next is to get this paper into the hands of finance directors and fisheries ministers the world over, because if the World Bank is interested, leading philanthropists are interested, if the billion people who depend on fish for protein need these kinds of solutions, well, then there's about a billion reasons to make these investments. Thanks, Steve.
Thank you, Brett. And last, we'll turn to Mike Arbuckle from the World Bank to put this in the perspective of linking the paper to the broader global development agenda of the World Bank.
Thanks, Dave. It's Michael Arbuckle. I'm a senior fisheries specialist at the World Bank. This paper for us starts to tease apart the challenge we're facing in restoring the natural capital of fisheries in the world's oceans. For the World Bank, it really underscores the important fact that this is a development problem, and in particular, it highlights the fact that these small and unassessed fisheries are in worse shape than others. Many of these, of course, are most important to our client countries and our agenda to help reduce poverty. As Brett mentioned, the silver lining here is that we have proven solutions that they've described. These solutions offer win-win outcomes, increasing economic outcomes and also the food security benefits. Now, the challenge, though, is to scale these sorts of solutions up to meet the global challenge. And the World Bank has already a billion-dollar portfolio aimed at building the capacity of developing country governments to better manage fisheries. But we've also launched a global partnership for Oceans Initiative, which specifically targets rights-based management as a key plank in addressing open access problems with fisheries. The Global Partnership for Oceans is a growing alliance of more than 100 governments, international organizations, civil society groups, and private sector interests committed to this idea of returning oceans to a healthy and productive state. We focused on three components around the food security and sustainability elements of seafood and the contribution to livelihoods, building habitat protection and also reducing pollution. We are in the process now of developing a framework document that seeks to catalyze the investments needed to close this gap in oceans management. And to reiterate, we realize that ending this open access problem in favor of fishing rights is a key part of that process. Well-defined, secure fishing rights provide these strong incentives to fishers in the communities and associations to stop this waste economically and in terms of food security. That's what I'm going to say.
Thank you, Mike. So just by way of summary of the speaker's comments before we open this up to questions, I'd just like to note that this is a topic that has received a lot of speculation over the last couple of decades and a lot of concern about the status of the world's fisheries. The benefits of this paper is it provides a comprehensive and quantitative look that expands our insight in terms of how fisheries are doing in a variety of different regions for different kinds of fisheries and different sizes of fisheries that is much more comprehensive than any report that has been released to date. Although the findings show some major challenges that need to be met, they also show that the problem is not so bad that there isn't the potential for rapid beneficial change if we take the appropriate actions. And the key to meeting this challenge is having effective tools. And as you've heard from the last three speakers, I think there's clear evidence from individual studies and concerted efforts to expand these for examples of utilizing tools such as rights-based management, the combination of exclusive fishing zones and marine protected areas into comprehensive packages. And the real challenge of meeting the effort that it's going to take to meet the challenge of this paper is going to be how do we scale this to the level of the global problem as identified in this paper. So let me turn this back to the operator now so that we can open the line up to questions, and I will help line up the speakers in terms of answering your questions.
Thank you. At this time, if you would like to enter the queue for a question, please press the star and 1 on your touchtone keypad. You can withdraw your question by pressing the pound key. Once again, star and 1 to ask a question. We'll pause for a moment to allow questions to queue. And our first question will come from Erica Bolstad with McClatchy. Go ahead, please.
Hi, thanks so much for having this call. I think this question is probably best directed at Amanda, and I was hoping you could speak a little bit about the models in the U.S. that might be applied to the findings of this report including in particular the management of the pollock fisheries in Alaska?
Sure. So the pollock, Alaska actually has been at the leading edge of rights-based management in the U.S., and pollock is one of the fisheries, as well as halibut, that have shown tremendous results under catch share programs. Pollock is actually a fairly well-studied fishery. There's a lot of science that goes into pollock. It's overall a very high-value fishery. Actually, it's one of the biggest fisheries in the United States. But it has a very similar history as a lot of other fisheries around the world. There was a race for fish that had a lot of waste, and the stock, the overall population of fish declined. It had reached a high, the highest catch was in 1972. The fishery overall declined after that. A catch share program was implemented in 1999, and since then the fishery has recovered and stabilized. One metric of that from the fisherman's perspective is that the season actually extended from 74 days a year under the race for fish to 285 days a year where the fishermen can go fishing. In just the last few years, the pollock fishery landings have gone up 30% in 2011 over 2010. It's actually a tremendous success story for the U.S. and for the world. There are other fisheries in Alaska that probably don't have as much science that goes into the setting of limits as pollock does. The paper we're talking about today is really focused in on how do we get these unassessed fisheries to have a trajectory of recovery like we've seen in pollock. And I think there's a lot of tools that have been that are being developed in the United States in certain fisheries that, as Chris had mentioned, allow us to estimate population abundance and sort of the health of the population without having to do a huge amount of and very expensive science. So I think the key next step for fisheries around the world, these unassessed fisheries around the world, is taking the lessons of these rights-based programs, including pollock or halibut, but applying them in design, but also scaling up the approaches to better estimate what the health of the fish population is with less resources and sort of less input. And there are certainly ways to do that. I see that as a potential bright spot going forward.
Thank you.
And once again, you may press star and one to enter the queue for a question at this time. And our next question comes from Lewis Smith, who is a freelance reporter. Go ahead, please.
Hi, I was just hoping you can give me some examples of some of the small fisheries, both fish types and the countries that they're next to.
Chris, do you want to take that?
Sure.
Sorry, go ahead. Brett,
did you say
you
Chris? No, go ahead, Chris.
Okay, I'll start and then you can follow up. So this is Chris Costello, and I'll speak with respect to the data that we used in the paper. One of the things we were able to do is to break the world up into what are called fish types. So the FAO, the Food and Agriculture Organization, which collects all the harvest data on fisheries around the world, has certain fish categories, and we were able to tease our results apart and look at how different fish types fared in these unassessed fisheries. And we found that as I mentioned in my remarks, the slow growing and sort of late maturing fish, the ones that just really can't bounce back as quickly to overfishing, those intuitively would seem to be the ones that would be in the worst shape. And in fact, that's what we found. So the worst category were the sharks. There's a large grouping of coastal fish that were also in pretty bad shape. Somewhat surprisingly, we found that fish like tuna tend to actually not be in terrible shape. Now, there's a huge range there. You know, we always hear about the Atlantic bluefin tuna, which, of course, has undergone underfishing and is in terrible decline. But many tuna stocks around the world are actually in pretty healthy condition, according to our results. And I think intuitively small fish like sardines or anchovies or herring also tend to be in reasonably good condition. The second part of your question, I think, had to do with different regions of the world, and we were also able to break our results, you know, out by region. You know, we were a little bit surprised to find that this isn't just a developing world problem. Many parts of the developed world, including the United States, including Canada, including the EU, while their assessed fisheries, for example, the pollock fishery that Amanda talked about, tend to be in reasonably good shape, many of their unassessed fisheries are not. And, you know, this may come as a surprise to some people, but on the other hand, because these fisheries are unassessed, it's very hard to, it has been very hard in the past to know when you're fishing them too hard. So we think that hopefully this report will raise awareness about that, and then this idea of these data poor stock assessments coupled with these new approaches for management that you've been hearing about, we think can turn them around in both sets of countries, the developed and the developing world.
Once again, you may press star 1 to enter the queue for a question. We'll pause for a moment to allow additional questions to queue. Once again, you may press star and 1 to ask a question, and we do have a question from Alistair Doyle with Reuters. Go ahead, please.
Thanks very much for doing this. I wonder if you could just tell us a little bit more about the confidence intervals, I guess, that this is about. Just, you know, these are unassessed fisheries. How do you know that the ones that you have assessed or that have been assessed for this study are representative of the other ones?
What an excellent question. You sound like a statistician. This is Chris.
I'm sorry, I'm not. No, I'm not at all.
Okay. Steve, should I start on this and then others can weigh in if they like to?
Yeah.
So this was, I would say, the biggest scientific hurdle that we had to overcome in the analysis, and the reviewers of the paper, you know, made us do a lot of different robustness checks to ensure that, you know, these results are believable. So let me just kind of give you a little bit of that story. What our method did is, so what we didn't do is to just look at the assessed fisheries, the 250 or so around the world, and then say, well, those are in X condition. Let's just assume that the unassessed fisheries are in the same condition. We did not perform that analysis. What we did is we built a very large database of all of the assessed fisheries, and we looked statistically for patterns in those data. And specifically what we did is look for, you know, how do different life history variables, things like how, at what age does the fish reproduce, or how quickly does the population rebound from collapse, those sorts of things. We looked at how those variables interact with how much you catch, so how hard you fish the population. And the reason we wanted to interact those two is that, you know, you could imagine a shark fishery and a very slow-growing species that can't rebound very quickly, and an anchovy fishery that rebounds very rapidly. If you harvested the same amount out of both populations and you harvested a little bit too much, the shark population would take years to recover, maybe decades. The anchovy population could recover in a year or two. And so different populations respond very differently to the same harvest series. So we found those patterns statistically in the stock assessed database. And then we built a database of all the 10,000 or so unassessed fisheries, at least the ones for which data exist. And we could apply those lessons to the unassessed fisheries. So that's sort of step one, is how we built the model. Then what gives us confidence that we're actually getting reasonable results? We did a number of checks. So, for example, we could use our method to predict the status of fisheries that actually already contain stock assessments. And we found that our method predicted something very close to the actual number. We also did other checks, like we were able to look at information from inside and outside marine protected areas, and use that difference in population between inside and outside to as an external validation for what the population was of that species, and then compare that against our results, and those were also very similar. So we did a number of those robustness checks. The last little point I'll make is that statistically speaking, as you mentioned in your question, we actually can give a confidence interval. So for each estimate, we can give a range, and we have a midpoint and a range for our estimate. When we predict for individual stocks, that range is quite large. So we actually don't think this tool can be used to accurately predict for a single stock. But as soon as you aggregate up to, let's say, 50 or 100 stocks, so you know, the fish on the west coast of the United States, or the fish in the Mediterranean Sea, or, you know, all tuna fisheries in the world, then you start to get quite tight confidence intervals and quite reliable estimates.
Great. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Once again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star and one at this time. And our next question comes from Laura Peterson with Greenwire. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, hi, thanks. I was also interested in kind of the data that went into it, into the model. So could you talk more about how we've tried to, like, what data you are using for the stocks that are, quote, unassessed?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Steve, would you like to take that?
I thought it was the moderator here.
Oh, okay, fine.
No, I'm just kidding. I'm happy to do it. So what we tried to do in this study, I didn't mention that I'm also a co-author on this paper, but is to utilize only information that's readily available for a large number of stocks around the world. And so those include records of the pounds of fish that are being caught over time, so the time series of catch, which is something that we can get for thousands of fisheries from the FAO, as well as some simple biological data that Chris described, some characteristics of the different species, some things like their growth rate, how quickly they mature, and a variety of things along those lines, the kinds of things that we can get from the scientific literature. So it's a combination of catch records, and in most of these cases, we're talking about decades of catch records, so it's a fairly comprehensive database, as well as simple biological measures that help us interpret different patterns in the catch would tell you. And those two kinds of information are available for thousands of fisheries.
Got it. Okay.
I'll just add one thing. This is Chris. We also looked, this is part of Steve's first category, the catch category, but we thought it might be important, and it did turn out to be important, that when and how quickly the fishery developed. So, for example, a fishery that started in the 1800s and ramped up relatively slowly and then has had constant catch or roughly constant catch for 100 years, that fishery, it turns out to be in very different shape than a fishery that, let's say, really started up in the 60s or 70s and ramped up very rapidly, let's say in a decade, and then collapsed, and then catches went down quickly. So we looked not just at the sort of the most recent catch records, but we looked at the whole history of the catch records, and that those turned out to be informative on the current status, the current biological status.
Thank you. Once again, you may press star and one to enter the queue for a question at this time, and we will pause momentarily to allow additional questions to queue. Once again, star and one to ask a question. And we do have a follow-up from Laura Peterson with Greenwire. Your line is open.
Great. Hi. So I guess maybe this is obvious, but I'll let you tell me, is why is it important to have these assessments? I assume it's related to setting those limits in the management, but could you talk to that?
Yeah, Deep, would you like me to do that?
Sure. Chris, why don't you take that one?
Okay, so stock assessments, formal stock assessments, which, as I mentioned, exist for about 250 fisheries in the world, are very expensive and are important for management because they provide a model for fisheries managers about the current status, but also about how a fish population will respond to changes in management. So if you were, for example, considering an increase in catch, a stock assessment would help you determine whether, you know, what the likely consequences of that increase would be over time. Like I said, that those exist for a very small fraction of the world's fisheries. And, you know, so at least in my mind, I've always got this small-scale coastal fishery in the Philippines that RARE or Environmental Defense Fund is working on, and none of those stocks have formal stock assessments. So you might wonder, well, how do you know how to manage a small-scale fishery like that? And there are really two possible ways to do it. One is a very centralized way to do it. You can try to impose management rules from the top and say, well, here's how much you could catch or here's how many people can participate. And the other way is the method that we heard about most on the call, which really involves getting fishermen involved in the science, in the monitoring, and in the management of their own fishery. And you do that by providing some kind of access rights or exclusive access rights. Now, the issue is that until now, we really didn't have a sense of what the status of those stocks were. So we didn't know, are they overfished? Are they underfished? Do we even need to worry about development efforts like the World Bank and environmental groups are engaging in? And I think the answer, it seems to be yes, those are important efforts because, first of all, it's exactly those stocks, the small-scale, unassessed stocks, that turn out to be in the worst shape in the world. So those are the stocks most in need of recovery. But secondly, because we found that they aren't yet collapsed, most of them are not yet collapsed, now is the time to act. If you wait another 10 years, given the continued declines, many more will be collapsed, and you either won't be able to recover them, or it will take much longer time and cost much more money to do. So maybe I missed your question, but to me, that's the real value of having this assessment now, is to sort of light a fire under the global fisheries community that says, now's the time to act. If you want economic prosperity and ecological prosperity, you can get that in a relatively short time, but you should act now.
And let me just add to that, Chris. This is Brett. In addition to this being the right time, it's also there are tools that make this possible. So increasingly, there are these data poor stock assessment methods that are being developed, where instead of spending $500,000 to assess a stock, it's possible to spend less than $5,000. There is even one researcher who's sort of developing what he calls the $500 stock assessment. So now you imagine how this plays out in the developing tropics, whether you're in the Philippines and Indonesia or Mozambique, where poor coastal communities who depend more than all of us on these fish stocks and on the mangroves and habitat that protect their coastlines from climate change, if they're put in charge with local government agencies of managing their own fishery. So they're given these territorial use rights, and in exchange they agree to set aside no-take zones, which become the local engines of recovery. The next question in the logic chain is, well, then what happens as those fish start recovering, you know, in some dramatic ways as have been outlined? How are they going to manage those fisheries? And this is when we need to put in their hands immediately these even self-managed fish stock assessments that are on the cheap that they can carry out year to year to make adjustments in the way they manage their fishery. So this is about sort of empowering fishers and decentralizing management so that those most dependent upon them can help boost en masse globally this fish recovery, at least, you know, the fish that the poorest people are most dependent upon.
And this is Amanda. I'd just like to add, Laura, a few weeks ago you had the opportunity to meet with Buddy Gwinden from the Gulf of Mexico. Mm-hmm. He was talking about the difference between red snapper and grouper and some of the other reef fish in the Gulf.
Mm-hmm.
And just to put a finer point on this, the species that, you know, that Buddy and his colleagues are seeking to get into catch share programs in the Gulf that aren't already in catch share programs are some of these species that are unassessed. So it is happening here in the United States just as much as it's happening in other parts of the world. And you see a real difference in the management of the assessed stocks versus the unassessed stocks. And the best thing we can do is actually get good management in place and use that as sort of a way to get to improve the science overall.
And once again, you may press star and 1 to enter the queue for a question at this time. And our next question comes from Janet Rayloff with Science News. Go ahead, please.
Hello.
Yes, Janet, your line is open.
Okay. I'm not quite sure who this is for, but what I'm wondering is who fishes the unassessed stocks and why are they unassessed? Is it because they're so small or it's species that people in the bigger countries aren't interested in, and what kind of fish fall into this? Are they largely predator or mid and low-level grazer species? Can you characterize sort of the fishers and the fish that fall into this unassessed category a little better for us?
Michael, you want to take this one?
I guess I can answer some of it. Certainly the developing country context is important because there's not the funding available to do complex, expensive stock assessments. And as a number of people have already pointed out, one of the challenges that is being addressed here is finding cost-effective ways of doing that and particularly incentivizing those fishers that are involved in the process to engage in providing better information on the status of the fisheries that they rely on. So I guess the answer is that a lot of these unassessed stocks do come from areas where there isn't the national funding and government agencies to do that kind of assessment. But secondly, of course, in a developed country context, there are a lot of unassessed stocks that are not generally the high-value target fisheries. And you see globally a lot of the focused institutions are assessing the high-value species, but there's many other species that are yet to be assessed. And I'm putting words in Chris's mouth here, and I guess that they are some of the types of fisheries that are not assessed. Chris, you might want to add something.
Sure. Just briefly, I mean, I agree with what Michael has said. My quick answer to your first question is most of the world's fishermen. And my quick answer to your second question regarding the species types is that really there's broad coverage across all species types in the unassessed category. So while it's true that most stock assessments exist for, you know, high value fisheries in the developed world, there are species like those species in many parts of the world that are unassessed.
Gotcha.
So it's not just, you know, tiny little fish that are caught in the Philippines.
Thank you.
And it appears we have no more questions at this time, but another opportunity to enter the queue for a question. Please press star and 1 at this time. We'll pause just momentarily. And it appears we have no more questions at this time.
Okay, any last comments by our speakers then?
Hey, Steve and Chris, this is Brett. I'll just say congratulations. Great paper, and thanks for all that hard work.
Now the hard work is yours.
And it does appear we have no more questions in queue at this time. I'll just turn it back for closing remarks.
Yeah, I would like to thank our speakers for adding their comments here, and for all of those that joined us. Hopefully this will be a stimulus to take global action. I think this paper is going to have the potential of really reframing the debate on a lot of fisheries issues and casting it in a way of presenting a real positive way forward in terms of dealing with the challenges both for the conservation of fish and the livelihoods and food that people derive from them. So thank you all for joining us.
This does conclude today's teleconference. You may disconnect at any time.